Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Doher and Tom Breeze. Episode 17, Easter Special 2025.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. You have landed on another light Easter special episode where we bring you three light offerings.
All right.
From a range of different sources, not necessarily education related, as you sit there with a mountain of chocolate, hopefully tucking in. And enjoying 2 weeks of well-deserved rest if you are a teacher or working in education. So, Tom, are you going to hit me with your hardest piece first?
Well, I can do. We started recording without deciding who was going to go first. So does that mean you've got some absolutely belting thing to end the episode with?
Do you?
Not hugely.
Well, you've seen behind the curtain, or hearing behind the curtain now, listeners.
I don't mind. I don't mind going first. I can go first. You think I've got something horrible, don't you?
I do.
The first one, and you want to get the pain over with. All right, I'll go first.
Go on.
Right. So I have got three things. They are fairly varied. Only the first one would be the sort of thing that would make you twitch, Emma. So we'll get it over and done with.
Thank you.
I have been kind of interested, as have many people, I suspect, over the last 6 months or so, by this narrative that has taken hold about the sort of the backlash against woke, the backlash against progressivism and the left, the fact that, you know, the Democrats in America got absolutely slaughtered is one narrative. I mean, you can argue over whether they did or not, but certainly there is a sense that there was a bit of a turning of the tide internationally against the so-called woke. And I was sort of interested as to whether that was actually truly a thing or whether that was history being written by the victors, whether actually it wasn't that you know, people were so woke and that was why the left got destroyed, all that kind of thing. But I've just brought something interesting in today, which is from a think tank called More in Common. And the idea of More in Common is that they have divided the UK population into these demographic segments, and they're trying to encourage them to talk to each other a little bit more. They're trying to fight against polarisation. But in this recent report by their boss, or their bosses, Ed Hodgson and Luke Trill, they chose instead to focus on one group of their seven segments. So they have their segments. They're called progressive activists, civic pragmatists, disengaged battlers, established liberals, loyal nationals, disengaged traditionalists, and backbone conservatives.
Wow. That's a list.
We don't need to go into painful amounts of detail about what all of those people are like. But rather than concentrating on trying to bring these different groups together, for a change, they decided to have what we probably shouldn't call a deep dive into the people of the moment, progressive activists.
Okay.
And found out a few interesting things about them. So if you want to go and find the report, it's on the More in Common website, and it is called Progressive Activists. And they are proposing one or two things about them. Which maybe they might want to have a look at. So they've got the foreword in their report, which sort of talks about the Trump election victory. Commentators have speculated it marked a deeper and more universal turn against progressive politics across Western democracies. And so this is why they decided to dig into these people. So first of all, who are these people? These progressive activists. They make up 8 to 10% of the UK population, younger than average, more likely to be graduates, highly representative in represented in charity and public sector, not defined by demographics, but they are generally the youngest with an average age of 41, although 30% are older than 50, more likely to have spent time in higher education, 46% have degrees, 20% have postgraduate degrees, tend to have high incomes because they're highly educated, but because they're younger, they're less likely to own a home and they're more likely to have student debt. And so while they're educated and they're relatively high income, they are younger, and are less likely to be homeowners, to have large amounts of student debt. So that kind of paints a picture. Mm-hmm. And I suppose as education people, we are public sector people. We work in a world where people do tend to be educated at a reasonably high level. So we probably know quite a lot of these people.
I was going to say, it sounds like some of my friends.
Oh, so this is this first item then for me is about Emma's friends. So shall I tell you about your friends? This is like that thing the other day, wasn't it? The last episode when we did our voice-generated personality test. Okay, so progressive activists, otherwise known as Emma's friends, have a pessimistic outlook on their future. They say 41% of them say their parents will have a more comfortable life than they will have. For example, 52% of them say they've suffered from mental health problems. They're most likely to say they're often stressed, lonely, and sad. So you should probably go and have more cups of tea with your friends, Emma, because they're stressed, lonely, and sad. They tend to be left-leaning kind of economically, tend to be lefty. Now, this is where it gets interesting. They diverge from the rest of Britain in their attitudes to many cultural and social issues. They're more than twice as likely than the rest of the country to say they are ashamed to be British. They're the only of the seven groups to say Britain should be ashamed of the legacy of the British Empire. They're the only segment in which the majority of people say we should increase or maintain levels of immigration. So that paints a picture. They are a particular group in that respect. Mm. They are the most vocal group in many political debates. So 56% say they've shared political content on social media compared to just 14% of the rest of the population. They're almost three times more likely to have written to their MP or local politician compared to the other six segments. They're twice as likely to have commented on a news article online. This is where it gets really interesting. Progressive activists are less willing than other groups to make space for debate on divisive issues. They're the only of the seven segments to say we should prioritise protecting people from hate speech over protecting freedom of speech, and are more likely than other groups to believe that some issues should not be subject to debate at all.
Mm.
Very, very interesting.
Mm.
Here's another one. I'm not doing the whole report here. I'm just doing the ones that really jumped out at me. Progressive activists tend to overestimate the extent of support for progressive causes in Britain by a factor of two or three. So in other words, they, you know, if they say to them, for example, let's have a look, that I'm just going to pick a random one. Only white people can be racist, or all white people in Britain are racist, or we should abolish the monarchy, or something like that. They tend to believe that more people share their views than actually do in the country at large. They tend to think that twice as many people or three times as many people in the country share their views as actually do. So it says that if they overestimate their starting support, they're more likely to focus on kind of campaigning messages which are designed to kind of keep their base happy, keep their own tribe happy, rather than being sort of outward looking and trying to persuade those elsewhere who might be more sceptical of those points of view. What else should we say? Much of the language they use is popular with other people like them, but falls flat with other parts of the country. And it says they are unique amongst the seven groups that they've identified in being more likely to believe that certain viewpoints are not a legitimate feature of debate. So the majority of them, they're the only group with a majority that think that some viewpoints should not even be given space in a debate.
It's that that concerns me.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's another one as well, which I've lost because it's quite a large sheaf of paper I'm working my way through here. They were also, I think, the only group who would not be willing to campaign on something on which they agreed with somebody else if that other person held another view that they disagreed with. So, for example, they wouldn't join forces with a Tory, with a Conservative, on something that they both wanted to campaign on because they were a Tory. They wouldn't join forces, for example, with somebody who believed that Israel had a right to exist, even if it was a completely different issue. So there's some really, really interesting stuff there about the fact that they are the group who are most likely to sort of turn in on themselves, to be least tolerant of other points of view, to be less likely to sort of reach out and discuss. I just sort of thought that was quite interesting.
I find that very interesting. I mean, 8 to 10% of the population is what you said.
Yeah.
And you said there are seven groups that they identified. Was that, yes, from that long list that you read out at the beginning?
Yes, yes, indeed.
And how did they sort of find out more about these groups? Did they interview? How do you find them?
Yeah, I think that this is a set of segments that they use more widely in some of their other work. And so they've obviously done lots and lots of this kind of surveying, interviewing work and have broken up the population into these different types. Because we sort of know, don't we, that the population has become quite polarized,
yeah,
and into groups. And the point they're making is that with social media echo chambers and stuff like that,
yeah,
they are talking to each other less and less,
yeah,
being fed more of what they believe. But in trying to sort of ask themselves whether anything has gone wrong on that very, very progressive end, they've found some quite interesting tendencies there, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because you sort of reflect and you think, okay, where have I seen these sorts of traits and behaviours? And the first port of call is on X or Twitter. And then you go, okay, but that's not, you know, have I come into contact with someone? I said my friends, and I'm going to retract that statement now. But, you know, it's causing me to reflect on, you know, some of the institutions I think we've talked about in the past, some of the more controversial academics out there who have been basically sacked from the universities because of the topics that they deal with, the views that they hold, or have been denied a platform at certain institutions because, again, for the same reasons, they deal in maybe sort of anti-trans rhetoric or research. And that worries me. I think I've spoken on this podcast about this before. It's sort of the extreme end of the continuum. And, you know, that unwillingness to even be in the same arena as somebody else, you know, to stand up on a similar issue but with someone who has a different opinion is a real concern. And it concerns me as a teacher, because, you know, everything that we sort of are attempting to do, I think, in schools is part of this sort of, you know, being open to different views, different perspectives, different cultures, backgrounds, being tolerant, being understanding. And then how does this happen?
Yeah, I was kind of interested because, as I've mentioned before, I like to read across the spectrum of publications.
Yeah.
And I really did find that in the wake of the Trump election victory, there was a lot of sort of triumphalist stuff, I guess, about the way that the left had dropped itself down a massive hole by assuming that everybody believed what they believed and kind of missing the mood in the US. There's a certain amount about universities,
yeah,
as well in those. You know, the Times and the Telegraph like to bash universities as these sort of woke fests where nobody dares say anything,
yeah,
out of line. And I've often felt it's a little bit overcooked, to be honest. They
yeah,
really have got quite an agenda against that stuff. But then when you read stuff like that, you think, well, that is kind of interesting that it's putting figures
is
on it, you know?
It's making me think about that clip that you recommended that I actually played out to some student teachers that we work with. During the presidential election campaign, and it was Obama, wasn't it?
Yes.
We need to remember that we've all got our blind spots and contradictions and prejudices, and that if we want to win over those who aren't yet ready to support our candidates, we need to listen to their concerns and maybe learn something in the process. After all, if a parent or grandparent occasionally says something that makes us cringe, we don't automatically assume they're bad people. We recognize that the world is moving fast, that they need time and maybe a little encouragement to catch up. Our fellow citizens deserve the same grace we hope they'll extend to us.
And he was sort of making the point that, you know, just making it extremely relatable. But I think, you know, the point that he was making is the one that you just said, is that have we just completely missed or given the wrong messages to or just completely sidelined a whole bunch of people by assuming that everybody thinks the same way as us. And he was given the example of, you know, we're all sat around a table with our families and somebody expresses maybe a racist view, you know, a really intolerant view, maybe one that's really misinformed, that's outdated, and we don't, you know, throw them out of our house.
Well, maybe some people do.
Some people do. But you know, would progressive activists sort of, you know...
The only of the seven segments most likely to throw their relatives out of their house.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, maybe they didn't ask him that.
You know, how are they operating in normal life, you know, as a progressive activist?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, at the risk of stretching this particular one of our six items way beyond breaking point, I think my interest in this, I think I've told you this before, my interest in this was sparked originally in the aftermath of Brexit. Mm. And I happened to be sitting in a Wetherspoons pub having my lunch prior to a very long, boring meeting I needed to do for work. And reading, you know, casually flicking through the Wetherspoons magazine because there was nothing else to read in there and thinking, oh, crikey, you know, he puts all his Brexit, you know, his pro-Brexit views here in this magazine. Oh, well, fair enough, you know, he owns his pub. And then you actually look on Twitter or X or whatever it's called, you know, the flaming hellscape that is X, and you search for the word Wetherspoons. And you do get a lot of pro-Remain people being extremely rude about the sort of people who go into Wetherspoons and suggesting, you know, all sorts of really unpleasant things about them. And that was when I think I thought, this is interesting. Maybe this is why they did not win.
I think this is why I find some of these things that you bring to the table challenging, in that there's no easy answer or response to this. It's just sort of it's quite interesting. Where is it playing out? How does it affect you as an individual and what you do? Like, you know, I always come back to education and think, okay, so what does this mean for us? But I struggle to sort of formulate my opinion on some of these things at times because they're quite complex, aren't they?
Oh, they certainly are. But that is why I enjoy reading all the goodies.
Yeah.
Not just things that I would agree with. In fact, I think I'd probably spend more time reading people who I'm expecting not to agree with, because I tend to find it more fun. Anyway, you survived that one. Well done.
I did. I don't know how that's going to come across in the episode, but I feel like our listeners are going to think, gosh, she's a numpty. It doesn't know her own mind.
No, not at all. It's good. You're not in an echo chamber.
All right. I'm going to take us somewhere else now.
Okay. Relief if it's palpable.
This is my heaviest one, but it's not heavy in the sense that it's going to make you squirm or not know what to say. It's heavy in that it's education related, and it's going to bring us back into the classroom. And it comes from the Education Endowment Foundation blog. And the question that is the title of this blog is, what does the evidence base tell us about effective oral language practices, maximising the impact of oral language approaches? And this is written by their content specialist on literacy, Chloe Butlin. I, just as a bit of a preamble, have always had a little bit of concern and a bit of a bee in my bonnet about oral language practice, oracy, whatever you want to call it. And it's really big now in the world of education. And it's something that expressive arts subjects, particularly those which deal with art forms that are quite ephemeral, that, you know, and classroom practice, which is sort of less tangible, you know, you're not going to see lots of writing and evidence of understanding come through in writing. And so, you know, talk is really important, like music and drama. I've probably said it on this podcast before. My concern is that we can assume that we do this really well because pupils are talking and have to talk. And, you know, with the rise of more evidence around oracy, you know, we've looked at things like dialogic teaching on this podcast before. She references this in this blog. She's sort of gone some way towards articulating those issues and given some solutions about what we can do about it right now. Now, this was written in November of 2024, so it's a little bit, well, it's not massively dated, but we're now in April of 2025. So let's have a listen to what she had to say. So everybody's talking about talk. Whatever your role in school, no doubt you'll have noticed the rise in interest in oral language. Deemed by some as the next big thing and by others as a passing trend, the topic is also encumbered by debates over definitions and practice. There is a dizzying array of terms to describe aspects of oral language: talk, debate, dialogue, and oracy. These terms are accompanied by a huge breadth of practice that includes presentational talk, exploratory talk, paired or group work, literacy, and debate. There are some well-evidenced programmes, such as dialogic teaching. However, the evidence base for many of these practices that broadly and loosely enacted in the system are weak. The strongest evidence is consistently being found for the early years and literacy, namely reading comprehension and vocabulary instruction. Because oral language involves broad practices and unclear definitions, there are challenges and risks, including the danger of superficial and performative approaches. This means it's crucial to interrogate the evidence for specific practices rather than assume any practice focused on oral language will be impactful. As the Oracy Commission's recent report, We Need to Talk, reflects, we most definitely aren't wishing to trigger a flurry of oracy gimmicks or supposed quick fixes to be marketed to schools and colleges. Phew, thank goodness for that. One way of guarding against superficial approaches, which are likely to have little impact, is to examine the area of consensus that oral language approaches, approaches that emphasise the importance of spoken language and verbal interaction in the classroom, are important and can make the biggest difference for our most disadvantaged pupils, especially in early life. A focus on the evidence would show that oral language interventions can have a positive impact at all phases of education, but the impact is highest in the early years, plus 7 months, and higher in primary schools, plus 6 months, than in secondary, plus 5 months. Oral language approaches are based on the idea that comprehension and reading skills benefit from explicit discussion of either content or processes of learning, or both. They aim to support pupils' use of vocabulary, development of ideas, and spoken expression. Effective oral language approaches are best integrated into the use of purposeful, curriculum-focused dialogue and interaction, and should be considered as a core element of developing literacy rather than a distinct subject area in its own right. And it's got a little diagram that I recommend you have a look at in the blog that sort of demonstrates this about how oral language techniques support reading instruction, vocabulary instruction, and writing. Maximising impact. The attention to detail needed to maximise the impact of oral language approaches underlines the need for sustained training and high-quality implementation to avoid lethal mutations, inconsistent delivery, or a tick-box compliance. For example, approaches which explicitly aim to develop spoken vocabulary work best when they're related to current content being studied in school. This needs to be delivered consistently and involve active and meaningful use of new vocabulary. So, is oral language the next big thing or a passing trend? Tethering oral language approaches to a tight set of integrated, well-evidenced practices, both in relation to literacy and the curriculum more widely, means that targeting talk can stand the test of time. So I'm really glad that somebody has written this. And obviously, the Education Endowment Foundation are very interested in evidence-informed practice and specifically those which have the biggest impact on the most disadvantaged young people. And I just felt reassured and interested in what they had to say. And obviously, there's more to read there and delve into. And they give some recommendations, some resources at the end of that blog. For it, and it really caused me to reflect, and it's prompted me to sort of think about the sessions that I do with my drama student teachers in and around this, because as I said at the start, you know, just because they're talking doesn't mean that they're developing, you know, talk for learning.
That is very timely because I was having a very similar conversation to that with a music teacher just yesterday. I was in a music department yesterday. Hallelujah. Doesn't happen as often as you might expect. And we were talking about the fact, I mean, we were talking about a lot of that stuff really, that they had had a little bit of a coming together with their overlords about the fact that there wasn't much pointatable evidence of literacy development. And of course, they were coming back saying, but we do high quality oracy. Of course, it's the nature of both of our subjects that actually what you chuck out the door in the subject is ephemeral as well, and quite hard to generate something pointatable. And so I suppose we are kind of more comfortable with the idea that I suppose the oracy thing is also ephemeral, but some of the people who have kind of oversight of us are not always happy about that. But I'm really interested also in this other danger, which is that we just sort of blithely go, oh, well, you know, it's happening, it's ephemeral. I'm not kind of capturing it in something pointatable. But how do we still actually know what we're doing is any good?
Yeah, and it can, for me, I think it sort of comes back to something that is very, very difficult in the arts, which is talking with confidence and knowledge and clarity and coherence about the effect of art, about the meaning that we're trying to convey with our art, about the techniques that we're using and the skills that we're implementing that express meaning or, you know, content. That is incredibly difficult to support. And it just got me thinking, you know, what would it sound like? What would the quality of talk be like in a classroom where there had been a lot of, you know, really good evidence-informed input around using the right vocabulary and being able to sort of articulate yourself really well when devising or composing within a group? You know, what would that sound like? And what would the practices be like? You know, I've seen some really good practice around when you're doing script work and, you know, pre-teaching some of the really important vocabulary is going to help them hook into the content of that script. You know, so there are all kinds of things. But what was quite nice was that this kind of came out and pointed to some of the stuff that does have a decent evidence base behind it in terms of practice. And then, you know, points us in some directions and gets us thinking about, you know, avoiding those gimmicks and those pointatable things. I just think we need more discussion as arts teachers around this.
Yeah, and as I suppose anybody that does oracy, I mean, in a way, as arts teachers, I think we've probably gone round and round the houses about how do we assess something so ephemeral and so difficult to nail down. And this is in a very, very similar place, isn't it? And so actually, we can probably have some interesting discussions with people from other subjects elsewhere. I'm just, yeah, really taken with the fact that defines these two almost equal and opposite dangers, that firstly you kind of create pointatable nonsense, or that you become so complacent in refusing to generate pointatable nonsense that you assume that what you're creating is high quality. I was sort of briefly, kind of mildly happy, I suppose, to hear that England made a big thing about oracy, didn't they, quite recently? But then because it was England, I did just sort of think, and maybe this is my awful kind of biases coming through here, I was thinking, oh, they'll definitely manage to kill the spirit of that and turn it into something dreadful. What was it, a lethal mutation?
A
pointatable gimmick. Yeah. They'll definitely manage to do that. I thought, I don't know, the jury's out. We'll see if they manage it, because of course, yeah, it is something that does need a bit of work, I think, but it's not easy work.
Not at all. Okay, so that was my...
Right, that's your heavy one.
My heavy one.
Some green vegetables for the listeners. Right. Okay, well, this middle one from me, just proving that I do read across the whole piece of print journalism, because this one's from The Telegraph.
Oh, okay.
Over on the right, for anybody who is not from the UK. But it reminds me of our good old well-being slot. Do you remember that? We had to bin that off after a season, didn't we? We used to have a well-being slot.
Yes.
But every now and again, we take a little well-being moment. This one I liked because, yes, it's probably got quite a lot of the old well-worn well-being tips, but it's also got a little passing mention of AI. In a way which doesn't do my usual thing of talking about how we're all going to die and the world's going to be destroyed by it, but just sort of makes us think about how we think and what we do and how we do it. So the headline is 7 ways to become hyper-efficient and avoid burnout.
This doesn't sound like a you entry. This sounds like a me entry.
I don't know. We all need to be more hyper-efficient and try and avoid burnout in higher ed at the moment. So here's a good one for us. This is some work by Dr. Mithu Staroni. I'm probably butchered that pronunciation, so apologies to Dr. Staroni for that, from University of Cambridge, talking about being hyper-efficient. And there were a number of things that grabbed me on it. We're not going to read the whole article. I'm just going to pull out the bits that grabbed me, like I normally do. It makes the point about AI. It makes the point about the fact that technology has not done that thing that I think we all naively hoped it would back in the day, which was that we would all, you know, be people of leisure while technology did all the hard work, whereas actually we're all just zooming around faster and faster like hamsters in wheels. And they're making the point that in AI can do, you know, 1,000 times as much stuff as we can do. It's very, very quick. And old Dr. Staroni says, in this new era, for humans to have a place, they need to be able to do something different. And that means qualitatively good work, coming up with creative solutions. AI might be able to produce 1 million mediocre ideas. Definitely having marked assignments, but I would agree with that. 1 million mediocre ideas, but that is nothing compared to 1 world-changing idea that the human mind can produce. So they're kind of arguing that we need to sort of get away from quantity because the quantity ship has sailed and get back to a focus on quality. And in trying to kind of work out how we do that, they have suggested that we need to think about which gear our brain is working in at the time. And
is this thinking fast and slow?
Is it? I don't know. I don't know about thinking fast and slow. You can tell me if it is. The idea that there are 3 gears to your brain. Right. How many gears does your brain feel like it's got at this end of the term, Emma? Mine's got about 1 and it's reverse, yeah. I think. But apparently gear 1 is a slow, floaty, daydreamy state.
Right.
So, yeah, do we all know those people stuck in first gear? But, yes, a slow, floaty, daydreamy state.
Man.
Yeah, really nice. Gear 2 is a state in which it's able to do complex work and analyse problems. And gear 3 is a super fast state where the brain can react quickly, but where it's unable to unravel complex problems. So I suppose we can perhaps recognise that in our own work. You know, I don't find myself in a dreamy state very often, but I think we do sometimes get in that old hamster wheel thing where we're banging stuff out, but we're not necessarily thinking deeply. I think they're suggesting that's the one that maybe AI will have an edge on us on.
It also sounds a bit like that analogy that they use in thinking about getting pupils in the right
flow, is it?
Cognitive space. Yeah. No, it's comfort zone.
Oh, yes.
Struggle zone and panic zone. So when they get into the panic zone, you know, you've pitched it too high. When you've got it in the struggle zone, you're in that healthy, thinking hard, thinking deeply, but, you know, nothing's coming too easy, nothing's crippling you because it's so hard.
Yeah. And I think old Dr. Staroni is suggesting that, and I'm sure we can probably identify this, you will spend a certain amount of time in kind of hamster wheel mode, just banging things out.
Yeah.
But you're not necessarily doing your best thinking.
No.
And what you want, I think probably what we like most of all, isn't it, is those days when we're actually kind of really engaging with things and doing complicated thinking. And perhaps there is hope for us that we can still do that stuff better than AI. And then the rest of the article is just a series of things that we can do in order to allow us to shift between our gears, not get stuck in a gear, perhaps get ourselves into that really good second gear where we're kind of useful. Mm. I'll just do the headings really quickly. Breaks and rest. Do you know, I will never forget getting a funny look off a senior person when I was in school because they found me sitting having a cup of tea and stuff. And I said, I'm having a break.
Wow.
You know, I'm having a break. My brain needs a rest. Early morning light. Avoid conflicting sounds. I love a bit of silence, as we know. Mm. Walking, bit of ambulare of Dr. Kev there.
Did a bit of that yesterday myself.
Yeah.
It does work.
Reset your body's temperature. Apparently, Dr. Staroni's a fan of yoga in a heated room. So there we are.
Oh, there we are. Carry on doing what you're doing, Tom.
Yeah, or cold water bathing or cold showers or something like that.
The Hoff.
Use your eyes to focus your mind. Stop, you know, your eyes flitting about. beware of stimulants, tea and coffee and the caffeine they contain. Yeah, well, I think that ship has sailed, to be honest. But, you know, it's a nice idea. So anyway, the idea that you need to kind of, I suppose, take care of the finely tuned machine that is your brain.
Yeah, do you know what? I would add to that list, and it's actually make time to do the second gear thinking.
Yes.
Like we've found good results, haven't we, from putting ourselves in a different environment.
Yes. We will not be disclosing where that different environment
absolutely
is.
Absolutely not.
Because no one can find us at the moment.
Carving out a wedge of time and absolutely barricading it in the calendar so that, you know barricading ourselves in that room and, you know, ring fencing that time in the calendar so that nobody tries to steal us away for something else. And then going, right, we're going to do a hard thing in that time, and we're going to do all those extra things. Sometimes we go for a little walk, don't we? We have a bit of lunch, whatever. We refocus the mind somewhere else, take some breaks, but then we come back and it feels really productive, and it's actually quite enjoyable. I find it quite enjoyable.
Yes, at the risk of giving away our secrets, it's amazing how few people will find you in a meeting room two doors down from the Vice Chancellor.
Oh, come on.
Giving it away. But yeah, nobody goes there. How? Why could that be? I don't know.
So you're under the eye of Sarah. You're in the blind spot.
This is going to have to come out.
It's like when you're up against a wall on a cliff and the person's over the top.
Yeah, that one. Absolutely that one.
You can keep that one in.
Yes, there's going to be censorship in this episode, I'm afraid, listeners. Right, moving swiftly on to your next one.
Okay, right. Okay, I've got my second heaviest thing. Okay, so everyone's going to roll their eyes when I say this because there's been so much coverage of it in the media. Adolescence, Netflix, drama.
And as usual, I'm the last person in the world that hasn't seen it.
Well, my husband hasn't seen it either, so you're not alone. But there has been an awful lot. I'm sure you haven't escaped.
I haven't missed the news coverage.
The news coverage. Every outlet, every bit of, you know, every platform, you know, it feels like the world is talking about Adolescence, which is a drama on Netflix written by Jack Thorne and Stephen Graham. Stephen Graham also acts in it. The article that I'm going to read is going to give some of the sort of contextual details if you're not aware of the story, the characters, the situation. There are multiple, I think what's great about Adolescence is that you can talk about so many different things. You can talk about the content, you can talk about the scripting, you can talk about the acting, you can talk about the actors. You can talk about the fact that it is done via sort of a one-shot camera technique in that every episode is captured in one shot and therefore one take. Obviously, they did multiple takes. Sometimes they had to use their 13th take because if something goes wrong, then you have to go all the way back to the start, bearing in mind each episode is about an hour long. You could talk about, you know, the technical feats that they had to achieve in order to make that happen. Bearing in mind that one of the episodes takes place in a very busy school environment, and this is the article that I'm going to talk about in a moment. So lots of different things. It's not been without its critics and criticism. The angle that I was interested to explore came from a bit of a gut reaction, because I think it's about the second episode that is set in a school. And depictions of school in drama, in theatre, in arts, you know, are abundant, oftentimes quite negative. And I certainly found when I was watching Adolescence, aside from the multiple things that I really loved about it, the thing that left me with a bad taste in my mouth was the depiction of teachers and school, secondary school to be specific. And I thought somebody out there must have picked up on this.
I make it a rule not to watch any depiction of schools.
And so I did a bit of Googling, and I found an article written by Lucy Taylor in the Times Educational Supplement magazine in April entitled "Adolescence is Powerful TV, But Why the Tired Teacher Trope?" Amid widespread praise for the hit Netflix show, this teacher questions why, yet again, teachers have to be portrayed in such a negative light. So she writes, there's no denying that the Netflix blockbuster Adolescence has struck a chord in society. It's paved the way for a valuable open discussion on the manosphere and the toxic diet being fed to young people via social media. Parents have watched the four-part TV series about young killer Jamie in horror, forced to explore the very worst consequences of what a whole generation could be exposed to in the safety of their own rooms. Jamie's guilt is obvious from the start. It isn't, did he do it, but why did he do it? And the failings are all around him. The struggle of his parents trying to live their lives in the shadow of horror is the focus of the final episode. With his mum's words, we could have done more, resonating with a generation of busy parents. But as a teacher in a secondary school in the north of England, it was episode 2 that really made me sit up. The school attended by typical suburban teen Jamie is presented as what can only be described as chaotic, a hotbed of tensions and prejudices in which teenagers brazenly flouted rules. In fact, at one point, a boy jumps out a window and are either glued to the phones.
Someone did that to me on my second PGC present.
He was on the ground floor.
Yes, and mine.
That's a story for another night episode. And are either glued to their phones or watching a video in lieu of any teaching. At one point, I think some supply teacher. No, I think they're like an NQT sticks on a video at the start of the lesson. Worse, the adults in supposed authority are presented as at best disorderly and weak and at worst disaffected and downright unprofessional. TV series are inevitably going to draw on the margins. Who wants to turn on the TV to see a teacher on top of their planning, delivering pertinent and engaging PSHE form time, and then sitting down to engage in some CPD? You know, fair point. From the smoke fog of the staff room in Grange Hill to more recently the shiny corridors and perfect pitches of Truham in Heartstopper, schools are ripe for drama. But isn't it time to move on from the archetypes? Adolescence has all the teacher caricatures in there. The weak and well-meaning older female teacher, clueless in the face of marauding teenagers. The dishevelled and lacklustre new teacher, already disillusioned and resigned in the classroom. The aggressive authority figure bawling at the children, the well-meaning broken mumsy counsellor failing to contain the distressed best friend of the victim. Honestly, she just nailed it in that paragraph for me, Tom, because I was watching it and thinking, any more? Do we want any more stereotypes in this episode? Turn to any school-based TV drama and you will find the same, and then goes on to talk about some other ones. The majority of the adult population do not experience firsthand the inner workings of a school or fully comprehend the complex roles that teachers now occupy. We don't just provide a worksheet, threaten an impending exam, and stalk off to the staff room for the latest gossip and coffee fix. We're actively counselling, coaching, mentoring, nurturing, and in some cases, effectively parenting those in our care. She does start to lose it a little bit here.
Yes.
This requires skill, adaptation, and above all, professionalism. I'm clearly preaching to the choir. She's preaching to the choir. This is the TES magazine, for goodness sake. So she's saying it's time for the wider world to catch on. Negative portrayals of teachers in the media matter because we need all stakeholders on side for schools to be effective. If parents and the public are fed a line of laziness, powerlessness, and ineptitude, they start to believe it. And that did strike a chord, given that we are in a, recruitment and retention crisis. If this is, to how people are perceiving the profession, then it's not going to really help. The well-oiled news machine has been quick to pick up on the proposed changes to the curriculum to ensure that ideas of toxic masculinity are challenged and eradicated. But once again, this seems to be presented as a new thought, as though schools weren't doing this anyway. Fair point. It's time to switch the narrative. It's time to show just how hard schools are working to engage, foster, and grow our young people. And our efforts matter and do change lives. Maybe not in a Netflix blockbuster kind of way, but in an ordinary, everyday way. Well done, Lucy Taylor.
Very nice. And just to let you know, from season 8 onwards, this podcast will be known as Disorderly and Weak and Disaffected and Downright Unprofessional Talk Teaching. It's a snappy title.
It's a very snappy title. But honestly, I was really enjoying it. Then I watched that episode. I thought, oh, come on. I was sat there with my parents and they were just sort of absorbing. I turned to them and I was like, this is not what happens. This is not true.
I never, ever, ever. Well, I mean, I don't watch much TV as it is, but I never watch programmes set in schools. That way lies rage or insanity.
This
to be honest.
Is true. But this was kind of snuck in amongst, you know, three other episodes that, you know, focus on different things. So yeah, I took umbrage and I wanted to check that someone else out there was doing the same. So thank you very much, Lucy.
Right. Quite right, you should. Very nice. Very good. Right, we're on to our last one now. Slightly connected to the last one. It's from National Public Radio in the USA, and it draws on a journal article, can't remember which journal it was, one of the Cambridge University Press ones, by a food culture historian called Martin Bruegel, and it's about lunch breaks.
Ooh, nice.
Yes, lunch breaks.
Ooh, I'm getting a bit peckish already.
Yeah, and I have to say, actually, it's interesting, I always religiously used to take a lunch break when I was in school, and here I don't so much. I don't know. Maybe there's less structure in the day when you work in university. It's so easy to find that you've just missed lunch entirely.
It's like thinking in second gear. You've got to actively make the time.
Lunch.
to eat.
Yeah, but I think physically as well, being a music teacher, doing a lot of Key Stage 3 music teaching, I actually did have to have a bit of a calorie reboot.
Yeah, it's a physical in the middle of the day.
It was, yeah, and not so much anymore. And I suppose maybe I'm not the only one, maybe I am the only one, who's wondered why it is that, you know, the lunch break's not really a thing here and yet is really a thing in France. You know, people are pretty religious about their lunch breaks, apparently, in France. Perhaps not as much as people kind of caricature it, that they're all off for an hour and a half and having two glasses of wine with it as well. But there is a culture, I think there is a sort of thing where when you're employed in France, they either have to provide a subsidised sort of work canteen, or they have to provide sort of lunch vouchers so you can go off and spend these vouchers in a local place.
Nice.
So why is it that they have this culture ingrained in their work life and we very much don't, and are used to having our lunch al desco, as they say.
nice.
And what I had not realised was apparently it is illegal in France to eat your lunch at your desk. Did you know that?
Illegal?
It is actually technically illegal.
I mean, how did they even...
How is that even a thing? Well, apparently it goes all the way back to the late 19th century, when obviously workplaces were really quite different.
Yes.
Workplace in the 1890s, says Martin Bruegel, was full of health hazards.
Right.
So cities had grown, more workers had to travel to factories, and so their eating habits changed because they were not mainly working in rural areas and just, you know, popping home for a bit of lunch or something. Uh-huh. They were bringing lunch to work, or they were buying something on the way into work, quite like we would today, I suppose.
Yeah.
But as he says, as the NPR article says, picture workers picking at their food with their fingers in matchbook factories, seamstress sweatshops and warehouses full of heavy machinery, from airborne tuberculosis to phosphorus fumes. These work sites were far from sanitary. And so they actually made it the law that a workplace had to be sort of flushed out with fresh air in the middle of the day, and that also the people involved had to take their food somewhere else and go and eat it so they didn't get ill.
Right.
So sensible. They made it a law. Yeah.
Very sensible.
And they never actually got rid of it.
Wow. Also sensible. Stayed on.
Yeah. The legislation survived actually a sort of campaign against it in the early 20th century, when there was an unforeseen consequence, which was everyone was piling out onto the street and then there would be quite a lot of antisocial behaviour. And there was in fact a strike by women workers because they were getting harassed in the streets because they were out of their workplaces and they were saying, hang on, actually, can we eat our lunch in work, please?
Right.
But they said, no, you can't. It's not what you should be doing. It's against the law. It was suspended once. They actually suspended this law one time in February 2021.
Okay.
For COVID.
You all know why.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so people did kind of lose their legal right to have a lunch break away from their work. And then they had to decide, what were they going to do after COVID finished? Were they going to modernize and accept that most of the world eat their sandwiches over their keyboards?
Yeah.
Or were they going to go back to it? And apparently the decision was the law was coming back.
Wow.
So Martin Bruegel, he points out the lunch break does lead to better health outcomes, even though most people are not working in, you know, horribly unsafe factory environments anymore.
Mm.
But he says it does make workers more productive. So back to my previous article. But he says there's a bigger philosophical point. It's not just good for individuals or the companies they work for. It's good for society. People who eat together are able to talk about issues. They can work out tensions or different opinions. Back to my first article. They create a culture in which having different points of view is possible. It's the lunch break as a driver of conviviality, a place for serendipity, a public good. And so Bruegel, who made this argument, his argument prevailed and the lunch law suspension expired. French workers are going back to the daily ritual of a shared meal, carving out a space that they can get to make their own, even as they do it together.
Well, you all know what we'll be doing immediately after this.
Yes, off to France for our next bit of work. Forget that meeting room. We're off to France.
Say, go and have a lunch
break. No. We're all in now. We're off to France.
Yeah. Wow.
Absolutely.
Well, we'll see you on the other side, everybody.
I think we should all make a new terms resolution to try and have some lunch.
I agree.
With our colleagues. We used to do it. My school used to be next to a department store, which had a cafe in it. And every now and again, we would go, right, we're off next door to have lunch in the department store cafe.
Yeah.
Really nice it was too.
Very nice, yeah. There was a nice sort of connecting line between your articles.
Yeah.
Well done.
Can't say I planned it, because as you probably heard, it came to me as I was reading it that I had managed to make myself look like I'd planned it. But unfortunately, I am, what was that person? Disorganised and unprofessional.
Oh, you're that person.
Yeah, I'm that person.
There we are.
Yeah.
Okay, well... Mine are not connected in any way. In fact, this last one starts with a question. And I'll ask it to you, Tom. If you found a dead body in the middle of the forest, would you...
Would it make a sound? Would I make a sound?
Oh, gosh. Okay, start again. If you found a dead body in the middle of the forest, would you call the police... Or would you live stream it?
Would I live stream it? Goodness me. I thought it was going to be a harder question that. Yet no, I wouldn't live stream it, listeners.
Well, one of the main characters in one of my best friends, Becky C. Brynolf's debut crime fiction novel, has someone who does just that. So, hashtag I Found a Body by Becky C. Brynolf, which is released on the 24th of April this year. So not long after the release of this Easter special. It'll be, if you're listening to it the day this comes out, it's next week. Go out and order your copy. I think you can get it for 99p for the Kindle version on Amazon at the moment. It's published by Black and White Publishing.
What do progressive activists think of Amazon? Sorry.
Other retailers are available.
Yeah.
So I will just read you the blurb.
Just making an assumption there, is she's your friend, sorry.
Who, Becky?
Yes.
You know she's
probably a progressive activist.
Oh, okay. Becky, please don't come for me after this episode. I'm doing you a favour here. Okay, so the blurb reads, an influencer, a dead body and a live stream. Mona Hendricks may have just met her match. Detective Sergeant Mona Hendricks has enough on her plate. She's separated from her husband, her teenage daughter is punishing her for it, and she's having to babysit. When her daughter's favourite influencer, Kylie May, finds a dead body and broadcasts it to the world, Mona is thrown into a very public murder investigation. What ensues are two dueling investigations between a seasoned detective and an ambitious influencer, one using good old-fashioned police work and the other using sensational tactics to keep spotlight on the case and on herself. 9 years later, Mona is estranged from her daughter, relying on a cane to walk and bitter towards Kylie, whilst the murder remains unsolved. When Kylie, now a sleek TV contrarian, think young female Piers Morgan, approaches Mona with a well-paid offer to investigate the cold case, Mona has no option but to accept. Now, just a bit about one of my best friends, Becky C. Brynoff. She has worked in social media for a long time, has been a crime fiction fan for much longer, and after 10 years in London, she relocated to her childhood home of Scotland with her husband, baby, and mad border collie. Becky hopes to do justice to Scotland's rich tradition of crime writers. I Found a Body, hashtag I Found a Body, is Becky's first novel. Go buy it. You won't be disappointed.
Very nice. Let's hope her second one's not set in a school, eh?
Well, she trained with me, so...
That's true.
She'll have a lot of knowledge and experience. Hey, Beck, if that's not book yes. number two's setting, then maybe you want to think
an
about that.
Accurate portrayal of a school.
Yes.
There you go. I found a CPD folder. You can have that title for free, Becky.
Oh, brilliant. So those are my offerings.
Very good. Well, yeah. There we go. Six lovely things to, I don't know, enrich or make stranger your Easter break. I've found your Times Ed article about teachers here. I'm just wondering which adjectives to apply to us on the sign off to this episode.
Oh gosh, well, definitely frazzled is one for me right now.
Do you want to be self-centered and incapable or predatory and deviant?
I'll get back to you on that.
Okay. Right, there we go. Well, we will be back with something a bit more sane in 2 weeks' time. And in the meantime, have a lovely holiday.
Enjoy.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma Well-Meaning and Broken O'Doher and Tom Dishevelled and Lackluster Breeze. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart, both of whom have earned an extended lunch break. Providing the ability to live stream dead people are the sound technician Peter Lamben and our studio manager Adrian Rapps. We're stalking off to the staff room for the latest gossip and coffee fix. Until next time, take care and enjoy teaching.